Thanks, everybody, for being here. Okay, so we're doing a big book workshop, and apparently there was a wonderful one this morning as well. And isn't that great, right, that there's all this commitment to the primary source material of the Mother Program, and obviously this is something that's really relevant and important to us in CEA, how the big book, because in our first 30 days we're reading things from that big book. So this is just something you can do in terms of working with your sponsees, or put it in front of your sponsor if that makes sense to them. If you've been through myriad booklets of questions, and we have new booklets, so make sure you check those out. But this is just another thing to take a look at in terms of working the steps from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's that handout going around. And the steps are outlined really clearly in the book. So there are specific chapters and page numbers that correspond to the text, which can be really useful for you. So there are specific pages that correspond. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through the big book. Did everybody bring their big book, or do most people have big books? Isn't that cute? So we got one. I have one extra book if somebody wants to use a big book. So I'll leave that right here. If somebody wants to come grab that, just make sure you bring that back at the end if you would. I got to get the notes out of there and get it in my first one. But who has worked the steps as they're outlined from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? Okay, so there are people who've done it, and whether they've done it in this program or in another program. So some people have some experience with this. And there, I'm going to leave these handouts right here. So if anybody's coming in, maybe Jenny, you could kind of keep an eye and see if somebody, there's handouts there for the big book. So in terms of taking somebody through the steps in the big book, the first thing that I always will do with somebody, so again, this is if, you know, I'm working with a chronic slipper who's been through the steps myriad times, they've answered all the questions. I don't take anybody through the steps of the big book if they haven't answered all the how questions, because those questions are just way too valuable. That inventory is way too valuable. Those step questions, those maintenance questions. So usually, you know, the people who end up coming my way are people who are kind of chronic slippers who've been in and out. So we're just trying something different. I mean, we have booklets in how that are dealing with the big book. So this is just kind of a, you know, another approach to it. For that matter, you can actually be working some of the step questions with your sponsor and be working through the big book as well. So you got all kinds of flexibility here. But the first thing I'll have somebody do is I have them read Chapter 7, which is the Working with Others chapter, and I tell them to pay special attention to page 96. And there's a paragraph right at the top. And I'm paraphrasing, but and I'll actually read the paragraph. But the gist of the paragraph is, it says, we find it a waste of time to try and help a man who will not work with you. So it doesn't say we find it a waste of time to try and help a man who cannot get abstinent, right, or will not surrender the food. It doesn't say that. It says we find it a waste of time to try and help a man who will not work with you. Now, quite obviously, I don't tell somebody if they don't do the work that it's a waste of my time, you know, off with you, right? It's nothing like that. But I just lovingly let them know perhaps they're not done. And the way that I'll know that somebody is done and that they mean business here, and it's funny because Rachel Ray and I were talking about this just a couple of hours ago, and somebody came by, and she then continued the conversation with them. The way that I'll know that somebody is done is if you do the work. This is not brain surgery. This is why I find it very, very easy to work with chronic slippers, because I know a lot of people find it very frustrating. I do not, because we're going to figure out in the first 4 or 5 days whether or not they're done. And if they're done, I'll know they're done by their willingness to do the work. Right, the food will come into line eventually. I have no control over that. They have no control over that. Right? I believe what we read at the end of How It Works, that probably no human power could have relieved our compulsion. Right? God, no human power could have relieved it. We're powerless over, and no human power could have relieved it. God could and would if he were sought. So that means it's going to fall into line. But always, as I tell people, you have to give me something. You either have to give me abstinence in the work, or you have to give me the work. But if you think that just giving me abstinence without doing the work is going to work, that's actually not a fit for me. Bless your heart, right? There are lots of ways to save yourself if you're drowning in the water, right? A blue boat, a red boat, a purple boat, a green boat, a red boat will save your life. But get out of the water. Get in a boat, right? And if you got in my boat, you got in a red boat, and it doesn't mean that I'm running the show. I'm real clear about that. God runs the show, right? God is the boat. God is the ocean. God is the oar. Whatever it is, however we're motoring around on the water, sailing around, paddling around, God is all of that, right? I'm real clear about that. But I'm also clear that you got in my boat. So we know that you're not the captain, right? I'm not... I mean, I'm the captain of the little boat, right? The little boat, the little captain. God's the admiral, the general, right? All of it, all in all in all. But you're in my boat, and with all due respect, I don't want what you have. Supposedly, you want what I have, which is why you got in my boat. And it's really okay if you decide you don't want what I have, right? On my bad days, I don't want what I have. So it's really okay. You're not going to hurt my feelings. I mean, let's just figure that out, always. But if you got in my boat, we're going to do the work. Because for me, as I read the book, it's real clear that it's giving me lots of direction. There are 92 musts or variations on the word must in the first 164 pages, including the doctor's opinion. So it's actually more than 164. But there's a lot of direction. It's very, very specific. There is a lot of work to do here. So I want to make sure that people get that right away, that there's going to be a lot of work. And I give people a lot of stuff, just like when we're answering the questions, right? We're answering a question a day. I mean, I came in how years ago, and again, nobody's doing this wrong, but I did not have a sponsor who said, you can take 90 or 123 days to answer those first 30 questions, right? It was a question a day. And again, I'm not saying anybody's doing this wrong, but that was really useful to me, despite the fact I was a chronic slipper for a dozen years, because I wasn't done. I wasn't ready to put down the food. But I got to tell you, it still meant a lot to have that adherence to daily work. I mean, and again, Rachel Ray, as I call her, double R, right? And I told her I was going to call her that. She said fine. But Ray and Fred were very, very clear about that there was a lot of work to be done. That's how this program ended up landing the way that it landed, right? They were clear that there was a lot of stuff to be doing on a daily basis. Thank you, Jenny. I appreciate that. So I love that. So I make sure that the person is very clear, right? So we read that Working with Others chapter, and then we're going to start with the step one portions of the big book, which are the doctor's opinion, Bill's story, chapter two, and chapter three, right? And they are reading a chapter a day and writing for 15 minutes and working all the tools on a daily basis. And it's not the tools, right, that solve my greater problem. The same two problems I had when I came in are the same things I deal with to a much lesser extent today. But they're definitely the same two problems. I used to weigh 200 pounds. I weigh about 138, 39. I'm not sure. Despite the fact I used to weigh 200 pounds and don't anymore, I never had a weight problem. I don't have a problem with sugar. I don't have a problem with flour. I have a problem with love, and I have a problem with forgiveness. Right? That's my spiritual malady. If you believe what we believe here and you subscribe to the 12-step model of recovery, right? And remember, the big book says we don't have any handle on recovery. So I have zero opinion about what somebody else does. I believe what we do here. I love CEA How. I found my tribe here. I found people that will return my calls. And I am not going to catch somebody off guard if I call them and I say, you know what, you got to walk me off the cliff. And the cliff is not drama with my husband, drama with my health, drama with my job. It's nothing like that. It's how do I make sure I don't walk in this shop and try and pretend I'm like everybody else who's sitting there, right, with a little plate in front of them and talking and having a conversation and taking an occasional bite or taking a bite of something and saying, ooh, dear, isn't that sweet? And I think, really, I have never eaten anything that is too sweet in my life, ever, ever. So that's my walking off the cliff. So that's why I am planted here. That's why I love CEA How, because you get me. But I'm real clear, this might not be for everybody. And the book says that. The book supports that. It says, and I love that. I love that they had that kind of humility. I mean, you think about this. They started working this in 35, finally got the book off the press 4 years later. They weren't even clear that this worked. I mean, it's really amazing. Think about the audacious things they wrote at the beginning when they talked six times in the book how the story of how thousands of men and women have recovered. I don't have a first edition of the big book. I'm doubting that they wrote then how thousands of men, I'm assuming that came in maybe on second and third edition. But they still talked about how people have recovered. They had that kind of courage about it. And I'm real clear the reason they had that kind of courage is because if you do everything that's outlined in this book, as we're going to point out some of the stuff here, if you do all that stuff, you will have that transformation. You just will. You just absolutely will. You will have a transformation. And if you decide to eat again, you're going to have to make a really conscious choice to do it. if you do all the work and you are doing everything that that book is asking us to do on a daily basis, this book. Okay? So we start hustling through it and going through it just like we do when we're answering the how questions, right? You have work to do on a daily basis. You're going to have reading and writing and working all the tools. Because the tools are going to help me again. They're not going to solve my bigger problem, that spiritual malady. That is, how do I get healed and transformed enough that loving becomes naturally, comes naturally, forgiving comes naturally? And when I'm in that zone, service is just a natural response to that, right? So people talk about it being about love and service. It's not for me. It's about love and forgiveness. Because resentment, remember, is just a $2 word for I don't forgive you. That's all the resentment is. That's why they're saying resentment is the number one offender. Because resentment is, I don't forgive you. And there is no way I can be holding a grudge towards you out in the world unless I'm holding a grudge toward me. And how long do you think I'm going to be able to maintain that before that kind of pain and anxiety is going to get me back in the food? And I can tell you, for me, as somebody who chronically slipped here for a dozen years, it ain't going to be long. For me. Right? So I've got to solve those bigger problems. And the tools don't solve those problems. But what the tools allow me to do, working those tools on a daily basis, what they allow me to do is get another day where I can check it off on the calendar that it was an abstinent day. So that then I can be clear enough to do the work where I'm dealing with those issues. Right? So those tools are amazing. And I got to tell you, I've been absent 9 years and a couple of months. I did not used to work the tools every day. I remember the meeting I was at. I was secretary of a big meeting in Santa Monica, and I had a wonderful speaker. It was actually the woman who did the big lead last night, Roberta, beautiful Roberta. She came and she shared at the meeting, and she talked about working all the tools on a daily basis. I don't know. I had 3 or 4 or 5 years. I don't even know how long I had. But I remember thinking, wow, she works the tools on a daily basis. Really? All the tools. Isn't that interesting? I've never done that. Right, you're laughing. You see, she's laughing. She's probably somebody like, well, of course, you know, and she's had eons of abstinence. She's like, of course. Right, and people really knew that. So I missed that one, right? And probably had wonderful sponsors who were, you know, giving me that kind of direction or suggestion, perhaps, right? Susie's like, yeah, I was doing it. I was right here saying it, right? My sponsor's right in the front row. So, And just wasn't taking it, right, which is part of my selfishness and self-centeredness, thinking I've got a better plan, right? I never have a better plan. And that's certainly what I'm always telling my sponsees. Be out of good ideas. Again, remember, I'm working with chronic slippers. Be out of good ideas. You know why? You don't have any. You actually don't have a good idea in your head, right? I'm inspired with some good ideas from the book, from people ahead of me on the path, from people behind me on the path, from just being here, right? I have lots of good ideas, and I've got some suggestions for you. You call them suggestions if you want to call them suggestions. But it's like a suggestion, I would say, if you fall in a pool and you don't know how to swim, I suggest you start moving your arms and your legs, right? Call them a suggestion like that. And if that word really makes you nervous, call them butterflies. Call them whatever you want. All I'm saying is the only correct answer to a sponsor is yes. It really is. And any time that I have not said yes to my sponsor, right, and I've got a really loving sponsor, and I'm really loving too, but I also really believe what this book says. So for me, I don't sponsor somebody to get them abstinent. I don't have that kind of power. If I did, my mother and my brother wouldn't be dead of diabetes. And my brother died at 36. And it was an ugly diabetic death, as most diabetic deaths are, right? He'd lost both of his legs. He was on dialysis the last 3 years of his life, right? So he started at 33, and he was in an old people's home for that last 3 years. And then he went blind. And he didn't want to live blind, so he said, take me off dialysis, and he was dead within 2 days, right? And when you lose both your legs as a diabetic, it's not like they just cut off both your legs, right? They start with the baby toe, then the next two, then below the ankle, then above the ankle, then below the knee. Then they start on the next leg. I mean, my brother was literally losing his body piece by piece, and it was really traumatic for him, as it would probably be for any of us. But he could not stop because in addition to his diabetes, like me, my mother and my brother were compulsive eaters with a raging sugar addiction. Raging. And my brother was bone thin, and my mother was almost 100 pounds overweight. Both had the same issue, right? Could not stop eating sugar. And they paid the ultimate price. So I take this very, very seriously. So for me, when somebody is working with me and not taking the direction that I'm giving, that isn't a direct response to everything that the book is directing me to do as a sponsor and the direction I am to give somebody, right? If you don't want to do the work, it's really okay. You probably don't belong in my red boat. I'm probably not the person for you. And there's lots of ways to recover. Everybody, raise your hand if you're a sponsor. Okay, so look at all the sponsors in this room. Everybody's going to do this differently. If you're drowning, all those colored boats will save you, but get in a boat. And if you've gotten in the boat of somebody and it doesn't feel comfortable for you or it doesn't resonate for you, right? Because I'm certainly never unkind to anybody. I love my people. I love them madly. But if you don't want to do the work and you want to just rest on being abstinent, this isn't a good relationship for us, right? It's not going to work. Why? Because I'm going to start thinking that a couple of days of that, you don't do the work and it's working for you, I'm going to start thinking it's going to work for me. And it doesn't work for me. I have to do a lot of work here. And maybe some of us are sicker than others, but I got to tell you, I think that baton gets passed from person to person, right? It goes all the way around. But I need a sponsee who's inspiring me. My sponsees inspire me. My sponsors all inspire me too. I mean, I love my sponsors. I would give my life for my sponsors, right? They're holy, holy women, and I adore them. But I got to tell you, in many ways, it feels like it's my sponsees who really keep me abstinent. My sponsors just keep me holy and moving toward God. Perhaps that's it, right? But I need sponsees who are doing the work. So then if they don't want to do the work, then I say, let me help you find another sponsee. I'm going to row you up alongside somebody else's boat, hold your hand while you're getting in Susie's boat, Rob's boat, right? Anybody's boat. And then I'll blow kisses while you're being motored, paddled, canoed away, right? Whatever it is. And hope that you're going to make outreach calls to me, right? But we got to figure out. So we'll figure out really quickly with somebody doing the work. So on that first day, they're reading Working with Others. Second day, they're reading the doctor's opinion. It's real important to get that doctor's opinion because it answers those two questions that I have, especially as a chronic slipper. Why can't I eat the way I used to, and why can't I stop now that I want to? Right? Because it used to work. I went on my first diet when I was in the ninth grade. It worked. I was real clear. It worked. And I tried to capture that baby for the next 15 years. I'd start on that day. I mean, you know, I'm into numbers, so I'm always adding up the numerical numbers of a date. And, ooh, can't do that day because it's a 6. Ooh, got to do this day because it's an 8. And 8 is eternal. And 3 is good, the Trinity. And 1 is, you know, it's all 1 and that U2 song. Right? All that stuff. I mean, it's just the nonsense in my head. So I have a lot of game playing that went on for me. So that's why I need to just settle in with the work. That work, doing the work on a daily basis gets my left brain taken care of. So we start with that doctor's opinion, answer that question. It talks about the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. Right? It's just not a debate. I do not have a debate about it anymore. And as a chronic slipper, I had a big debate about whether or not this was really a problem for me. I don't have that debate anymore. I'm real clear. You know, I've got a sister who's allergic to cats. And it's not like she's going to walk in a room and if it's a Siamese or if it's a black cat and it has one white paw, right, she's not going to sneeze and snot and snort. She's going to do that regardless of what's going on with the cat if she walks in a room. Why? She's got an allergy to cats. I have an allergy to sugar. I do. I have an allergy to flour. I actually have an allergy to dairy. It's hard for me to put it down. That's what I'm kind of struggling with and working with my sponsor. But there are plenty of things, because I pushed the limits for so long, I'm actually a lot more limited with my food. And I have some health issues and stuff are playing in there in terms of doctors, traditional and, you know, Western and Eastern doctors who are kind of weighing in on stuff. So there are plenty of things I need to know. It's just for today, it's not my food, right? But I want to get that information. I love what Silkworth, you know, I love his humility. I love these people, him and Sister Ignatia and other people. There were other wonderful people, people who were not alcoholics who loved us right from the beginning. So I love that people love us. You know, I got a husband. I've got people in my family who love me and understand me with my quirkiness. I've had employers who loved me and accepted me with my quirkiness with food. Right? I love that. But Silkworth in particular, really, I just think he's a lovely, lovely man. So that, you know, we read that chapter first, and they get that. Getting it, really bringing it home, that this is an allergy. You do not have any control over it, just like somebody with a cat allergy has no control over it. You walk into a room, and you're a cat. If there's a cat there, if you have a cat allergy, you're going to start wheezing, right? Mucus, everything is going to start flowing. Have no control. That's how it is for me with this stuff. So we get that. Then we go to Bill's story. Bill's story just gives me great, great comfort. I love that story so much. I love it because you just keep turning the pages and you just think, oh, man, come on.
When is he going to get it? For crying out loud. It gave me so much comfort. You know, I remember this was years ago. I was working in a job. I was working for a very wealthy family, and we were on a ski trip over the holidays. And I had I'd gotten back into the sugar before I went on this trip, right? So this was one of those periods, in and out, in and out. And I'd gotten back in, working for some, you know, this is not the thing to do, to be on a ski trip with a wealthy family, and you've gotten back into sugar. Trouble, right? So they sent me out. They had the kid, and they, the little two-and-a-half-year-old, so I had a free day, and they paid for me to work with a ski instructor all day. We were in Colorado, Telluride, and it was just, you know, he was a really good-looking guy, really good-looking, handsome. It was just terrific. His name was Mark, and I was just skiing, you know, I was skiing all day and just loving it, right? And at the end of the day, there was also things. They'd taken the little kid and gone and done something wonderful with her. So, again, I had the night to myself. And I decide I need to eat, and I need to eat something off room service, right? And we don't mention food items in house, so I won't. But on the menu, there was a conventional, right, treat, candy bar, I think I can say that, on the menu. And it was like $5 a piece, right? And if you'd gotten it at a 7-Eleven, you'd pay, what, at the time maybe 45 cents, but it was like $5, right, on this menu. I ordered 6 of them, right, because why not? Half dozen, makes sense to me. And the door, right, room service, I go to the door, open the door. It's the good-looking ski instructor who's doubling as room service guy at night. And he's got a tray with the silver dome on it, right, and walks it over the table, sets it down, lifts the dome, and there's the 6 treats on doilies. And I wanted to die. I could not get him out the door quick enough. I mean, that show wasn't enough. I needed heroin at that point. I've never even done heroin, and I needed heroin, and I needed a lot of it. Like, nothing could quell that shame and that self-hate and that fear and that lack of self-love, right, crystallized so clearly. And I will never forget the look in his eyes and when he looked at me, and I already had a ski lesson booked the next day. It was like, oh, man, are you kidding me? How did I get here? And as soon as he got out, at some point, I was in Howe, and I called somebody, and I laid it all out, right? Because that was the one thing I was pretty good at doing when I was slipping. I would still make the calls, and I would reach out to people, and I just, you know, took somebody right there. I told them the story, and they said, pull out your big book and read Bill's story. And I did, and right then I got so linked up, because as bad as I felt and as ashamed of myself as I felt, I knew I wasn't crazy. I knew I wasn't crazy. I was in pain, which is all that's going on for somebody when they're in the food. That's the only thing that's going on. It's just somebody who's in pain. It's not a moral issue. They're not defying me. They're not defying God. I don't make any declarations about anybody when they're not done with the food. All it means is that they're in pain and they're not ready to put the food down. And I have zero opinion about that. I do not know when anybody is supposed to put the food down conclusively. I didn't know when it was going to be removed for me and put down. Why would I think I have this idea for anybody else? I don't. Right? I don't. So that's where I got a real emotional link, is with Bill's story then. Because then he just gave me real great comfort. So all of a sudden this white Protestant guy, right, stockbroker, New York, all the things that I am not, that I have zero experience with, all of a sudden I feel so linked in with this guy. And I'm just in love with him. Because he understands my pain, and he embodies my crazy, right? And all I have to do is turn the page, because it's that same thing, like if somebody had looked at my life, like, oh, man, you'd think she'd stop now. You'd think that humiliation on the ski slopes would have stopped her then. I ate for another dozen years after that. I just wasn't done, right? Wasn't done. Hadn't had enough pain. That's all. So if I really believe at that point, if they really believe the doctor's opinion, right, that it's a physical allergy of the body and obsession of the mind, right, so even when you get it physically out of your system, I'm never going to lose this. This is why I need to be in meetings for the rest of my life. I never understand people who say, well, I don't have to go to meetings anymore because I just don't need to go there to stay off the substance. Even if that were true, if that's true for you, well, then you have something I don't have, because I don't see any guarantee about the book in, you know, saying that. But if you have, okay. But why don't you stay for the rest of your life and give it away like people were here giving it to you when you came? You know, that's kind of my thing. It's just, well, maybe you're kind of embodying that selfishness by taking what you needed here and leaving.
and then going and finding something in your spiritual community or whatever. And again, you know, so none of this is my business, as my sponsor reminds me. And, you know, I go to another program to get reminded all the time that it's not my business what anybody else is doing. So just, you know, get back in your hula hoop. Anything that's within my hula hoop, right, is what I have a measure of control over. Unless I'm in my hula hoop and I decide to eat sugar and flour. Because then all of a sudden, I don't have any control either there. So I don't even have control of everything within my hula hoop, right? But if I believe doctor's opinion, and I believe what Bill Wilson talked about, where all the things that he tried to get him to stop, and there were lots of things that Bill tried, right? Lots of things he tried. He had health problems. He had financial problems. He had made a strong resolution on page 5. He had a sense of impending doom on page 6, potential suicide also on that same page. Wanted to escape from life, went to elite treatment centers, was in town's hospital 3 times. It was the 3rd time that was the trick for him. Self-knowledge, fear, hopelessness. Now, hopelessness ended up working for Bill, but it doesn't work for everybody, right? Plenty of people who are hopeless, and, Skid Rows are full of them all over the world. So hopelessness doesn't work for everybody, but it seemed to work for Bill. But if I really believe that it's not even like something happening is going to be what's going to kick me over, then I can only eat on a lie today. Right? So if I believe doctor's opinion and I believe everything that I read in Bill's story, I can only eat on a lie today. And there are 3 lies. Right? It's not going to affect me this time. So I've always had a problem with this, but it's not going to affect me this time. 2nd lie, it's going to affect me, but I'll be able to control it. Right? Monday's coming. Monday's coming, and it's a good day. So let me, Sunday night, let me make sure I floss my teeth and, brush them and get everything pristine and stuff because it's a new day tomorrow. So 2nd lie, it'll affect me, but I'll be able to control it, be able to stop when I want. Or the 3rd lie is, well, I don't have any control, and it's going to take me out, but who cares? My life has no value anyway. None of those are true, right? And then we read, there is a solution. And there is a solution in that great chapter. So, again, we're still on step 1. And it's good because it just lets you know, wow, it's cool. There's a solution. Yay. You get to be in the solution. Terrific. Right? And they write on that, still on step 1. And then we read more about alcoholism, chapter 3. Because then it's like, it's the, what was that show that used to be on, something of victory and the agony of defeat. It's like, the peaks and valleys, right? Because you're in, there is a solution, and then more about alcoholism. It's just really bringing home that point that you have zero control over this. You have absolutely no control over this. As a friend of mine says in program, compulsively eating is like dancing with a gorilla. You're done when the gorilla says you're done. I have zero control over this, right? I know. And we have we agnostics. Usually I spend a couple of days on we agnostics. And depending on the person, we might read the chapter one day and then read it again the next day. Because the first day I'll have them write about whatever's coming up in terms of their idea of God. And then on the 2nd day, I might have them really write what they would love to imagine as the God of their understanding. Because you're going to be spending the rest of your life figuring out the God of your understanding anyway. My God is getting more and more loving as I go along, as I'm getting more and more loving and more compassionate. As my heart opens, my God becomes more benevolent. Go figure, right? It's like that Mark Twain thing. When I was 14, I thought my dad knew nothing. When I was 21, I was amazed how much he'd learned in 7 years. It's like, I'm amazed at how compassionate my God is today. Well, whose heart's open? My heart's open, right? I've become more loving. That's why my God's more. I get to worship any God I want to, as long as I'm willing to emulate that God. Then one God, many paths, is what I learned here, and that feels comfortable for me. So I celebrate everybody's traditions and blessings and, whoever your way shower is, right? I come from the Catholic perspective. Jesus is my way shower, and I celebrate Judaism. I'll always be a Jewish girl. I'll always be a Hindu. I'll always be a Sikh. I'll always be a Muslim. My husband's Jewish. I love it all. I celebrate all of it. So, I've got a buddy who doesn't believe in God. For him, God is G-O-D, is get outdoors. Terrific, right? Bless your heart. Got another guy, heard this guy years ago in AA, talked about, for him, electricity is the higher power. Because if he says, if he takes his wife's hair dryer and he dips the cord in water and sticks it in the wall, he'll experience a power greater than himself. Right? So, right, whatever you've got to do, whatever you have to do. In the beginning, I used to use Glinda the Good Witch from Wizard of Oz. I remember pitching that in a meeting in London, and a guy came up to me. Who knows? I mean, it must have been that because it was London. He walks up and he hands me a wand. Like, it was weird after the meeting. It's like, really? What are you doing? What if I hadn't pitched that? Would you have that in your back pocket? What's the deal? But, you know, just lots of things. For a long time, I needed to use an African-American male because I'd had too many issues with my white father, who, you know, my dad was a troubled man himself and had had an eating disorder himself. So, you know, he had three overweight daughters, and he didn't like it. He was very unkind to his overweight daughters. Well, that really colored my perspective of a god and a powerful entity, right? My dad was the most powerful one in our family. There's a direct link between how I think about my dad and how I think about my God. So I needed to use a black man for years, right? I'd had this wonderful professor at Michigan State who was just wonderful, this holy man, right? He was just the most wonderful, wonderful man. And he was, you know, he was this caring, loving black man. It just felt very safe, very unlike my white dad. So I've had different, you know, ideas of who God is and how God is. And for now, I've kind of settled on that God is the God within. So I want people to be in that exploration on step two. What is that God you're imagining? Knowing that, again, you're going to be on this journey and searching for the rest of your life. So all we have to do right now is find something that you can lean into right now. And if all you can lean into is the group, terrific. That's wonderful. That's a power greater than yourself. We in this room can do what none of us can do alone, right? And support each other. Right? Put the food down and solve our greater problem. Find that spiritual malady that the book talks about. Okay? So then we get on to, and the reality is, so it's chapter 4, it's step 2, and also it's from the beginning of chapter 5, from page 58 to the middle of 60. And we know that because you get to the end of A, B, and C that we read in How It Works, and it says, being convinced, we were at step 3, and the being convinced is both of the A, B, and C, and everything that it's telling you that we got to that point, that is, for me, that I'm going to have to work through all 12 steps. That's the reality. That's part of that restoration to sanity. So again, step 2 portion of the big book, we agnostics, through the middle of page 60. Okay? So now I've gotten clear about what it is I need to do for that restoration to sanity, and who or what or how am I going to experience that loving power that I'm turning my will and my life over to. And then we get to step 3. And step 3 is really crucial. It's especially crucial for people who are chronic slippers. It's always a step 3 issue. Because at the end of the day, I can turn over my husband, I can turn over my health, and that was really scary, right? I've had some scary health stuff. I can turn over my career, right? I'm an artist type, have yet to really hit one out of the park. Keep trying to get one out, but have yet to really do that. Yeah, so I'm kind of the overeducated, underemployed type. I can turn that over. I can turn over anything. I really can. My crazy, alcoholic family, compulsive eating family. I mean, I'm the only one in my family who goes to 12-step programs. Really? That's not even possible in terms of the numbers. But there's, what, 100 people in my greater family, and I'm the only one who needs 12-step programs? You can all go to another program simply because I go to this one, and I go to the mother program. You all qualify. I've talked with people in grocery lines and, you know, said to people who said, oh, I wish I could go to 12-step program, and I've introduced myself and said, now you qualify for Al-Anon, right? I'll be your friend. Here's my phone number, right? I've done that. So everybody, I got myriad people in my family who qualify. But no, supposedly I'm the only one. Okay. Right? Okay, fine. So at any rate, we get to step 3. So I can turn all those things, the crazy family, health issues, career, all that, I can turn all that stuff over. But turn over my food? What? What? That was very, very difficult for me. I could not put the food down. I wasn't done. And so I want to bring that home to somebody, and I say pay special attention to the paragraph right at the top of page 63. And I'm going to read it to you because this is my favorite paragraph in the big book. Right? When we sincerely took such a position, and the antecedent in the paragraph before is talking about how God's the director and we're the ones who are just kind of getting moved around. So when we sincerely took such a position that God's in charge and I'm not, also, and well, I'll come back to that, put that in a post-it note on the wall, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer, being all-powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. That's a pretty powerful promise, right?
Don't let anybody kid you when we talk about, oh, let's read the promises in the big book. Yeah, you better give yourself about 7 hours. This book is full of promises. Right? There's a bunch of promises there. It's just saying, if I will surrender everything and let God run the show, I'm not going to have any fears today, tomorrow, in the future, or in the hereafter, life after life, as I call it, or life after death, as some people call it. That's pretty powerful. But for me, especially as a chronic slipper like I was, for me to turn my will and my life over to God, I have to turn over my food. For me. For me. And even that's a process. As I shared with you, I mean, there are things in abstinence I'm still trying to conclusively put down. So, you know, things that are on our food plan that work for many of you that really don't work for me. So, it's all a process. But that's I'm real clear about that. That's a big part of the third step for me. And I kind of lovingly lay that out for somebody. Again, very clear about the fact I have no control over whether somebody's going to get this. But at this point, I'm very clear, because we're, what, 6-7 days in, that they're understanding that they're going to do the work. Because if you do the work, something is going to happen. I've never had anybody yet go through all the steps who didn't end up putting down the food. I've had people who, once we get through the steps, and then I lovingly shove them off, right? I take them to the landing, right? Hold their hand while they get out of my boat, and I say, go get another sponsor now. Go let Rob sponsor you. See what he says. See what, maybe he wants to take you through one of the new how books or questions, or, you know, thinks you should do the recommitment questions or whatever, right? Or thinks you should do a how inventory. Go see what somebody else has to say. You've worked with me for a couple of months, because it only takes a couple of months to go through the steps in the big book, right? And usually this is what I'm doing. Occasionally I take people through the questions. If people haven't done this, I never take anybody through the big book if they haven't answered the how questions, because those questions are amazing. But for the most part, this is, by the time people get to me, they've been doing this stuff for years, right? So we'll just try something a little different, right? That's, you know, this is conference-approved literature. This is stuff that, you know, CEA Howe, we subscribe to this. It's just kind of a different approach, because it gets down to causes and conditions, like it talks about when we get to the fourth step. It says we're looking to deal with causes and conditions here. So I want to bring that truth home, that if you are still in the food or struggling with the food, food is the most important thing to you in your life. And I just be okay with that. That's the reality. Stop lying about it. Just stop lying about it. If you're still in the food, food is the most important thing to you. It's more important than your kids, your husband, your job, your dog, your cat, whatever it is. It's the most important thing to you. Stop lying about it. Let's just tell the truth and do the work and see what God can do and program can do when you're surrendering. Because, again, one of the things people are also doing the couple of months that we're working together, you go to a meeting a day because you're at that point, right? You're at that point. Go to meetings and be of service at those meetings. Make sure you're reading something and contribute something at the meeting. And for me, I like to make a $3 donation, right, for my emotional, physical, and spiritual recovery. Because, what, even if I'm doing, and I do 6 to 7 meetings. Actually, I do more because I'm in other programs, too. And sometimes when I'm working with a sponsee who's really convinced they don't have time to do this, and I say, well, I'll tell you what, I'll do it with you. How's that? Right? You're not any busier than I am. Trust me. Right? We're all busy in this room. It's all about priorities. And if you get it that your life is at stake, you'll make time. Right? Because if you had a kid and your kid was really struggling, and you said your kid's life was on the line, you'd move heaven and earth to get to a meeting a day or answer the questions or meditate for 5 minutes a day, all that stuff, right? You'd find the time to do that. But you don't value yourself. See, we're back to that love and forgiveness thing. You don't love yourself enough to make yourself a real priority. You're selling out for food. Don't you always love it when Rachel Ray says that you're more important than the food? I remember the first time I heard her say that. I just thought, no, I'm not. No, I'm not. Right? Talk about a spiritual malady. Thinking that a bowl of whatever has more value than my life. That's off, right? Then we do the fourth step. So the fourth step starts at the bottom of 63. Right? Oh, and then when we get to that third step, usually I'll, you know, have us get in a situation where we can do that prayer together, that third step prayer. And then we do the fourth step, right? And we do the fourth step, right? You just had a workshop this morning that was led by Roberta, again, wonderful Roberta, doing that. She's talking about the four column thing, right? So we do an inventory as it's outlined in the book, right? We do, and take a week.
I give my sponsees a week to do the inventory. It does not take long. It doesn't take long. And there's three components to a big book inventory. There's the resentments, there's the fears, and there's the sex inventory. And it literally is just lining up columns. And it's, you know, I resent, right, or I don't forgive the cause, all the places in my life that it is affecting me to not have that forgiveness in place, right, to be angry at this person, to be not forgiving, all the places that I'm getting affected in my life. And then what is my part? And the part I'm looking for is, where am I being selfish? Where am I being dishonest? Where am I being fearful? That's what I want to look for. So take one hypothetically, right? I was molested when I was a kid. So I resent Joe. The cause, molested me when I was a kid, affects me in every area of my life, sexually, emotionally, physically, relationships, right? Every area of my life got affected by the fact that this happened when I was 10. But now let's get to that fourth column. Where am I fearful? Where am I dishonest? Where am I selfish? Okay, it's easy to see where I'm fearful, right? If something like that happened, I made every man in my life after that, including my husband now, because I've been with him for many years, they all paid the price. Every ex-boyfriend I have would cross the street if he saw me coming. Hopefully he's not going to get a gun. You know, I mean, I made these men pay because a pedophile hurt me when I was 10. Well, that's not fair. So there's, you see the fear. Well, in that, do you also see the selfishness? I do. Making you pay Tom Smith in college because of what somebody did to me 20 years ago? That's not fair. It's not fair. That's selfish. And is it dishonest? Sure, it's dishonest. I'm putting my anger, my hurt, my woundedness on somebody that had nothing to do with it. Aside from the fact, in terms of dishonesty, again, when you take it back to resentment, just means I don't forgive you. If I'm not forgiving somebody, well, that's dishonest. I wouldn't be forgiven in the world. Not everybody on my course that did bad stuff to me. I did a bunch of bad stuff to people. I was really hurtful to people. Stealing was a big part of my story. I had a lot of financial amends to make because I didn't have sponsors who subscribed to the idea of living amends. Oh, just live differently now. What? My sponsor said, no, precious, if you stole, you're going to pay somebody back, baby. So I did. I had to make a lot of donations to charity. I worked at a fast food restaurant and had stolen food, overate food, gave food away when I was in college. I had to make a huge donation to their charity, right? So, and that, those were life-changing things for me. And those were all things that came out of a four-step where I was seeing my part. And that's not my inclination as a selfish person, but there's something really profound. I mean, it happens on all of the steps, but something really profound happens if you work a big book inventory and you pay attention to that fourth column. Something really profound happens. You start transforming. Why? I move out of being a victim. I can't be a victim if I'm looking at where I've been selfish, dishonest, or fearful about having been molested when I was 10 years old. I'm 49 years old. Right? This is 39 years. I mean, I did this work years ago, but I'm just talking about it in the present. But when I did this at the time, this was amazing. I did this, I don't know, 20, 22 years ago. But this was a game changer for me. This changed everything. It didn't change everything so much that I ended up conclusively putting the food down and keeping it down. But I'll tell you what, I had a moment of sanity that day. I had a spiritual awakening that day. And nothing was the same again. And I got transformed because I got it that no matter how horrible something was that had happened to me, if I haven't forgiven that person, see, I wasn't responsible in any way for somebody having molested me when I was 10. But I was certainly responsible for the fact for 20 years I didn't forgive him, nor did I forgive that half of the human race. For that, I was certainly responsible for. And I want to be responsible today. Why? That's my place of power. Then I can do something about it. Then I am empowered as a child of God, as a woman of God, to make some different choices and be in different conversations. I don't have daughters, but I have plenty of nieces. Right? And I do. I used to be a teacher. Still am. I used to. Just took a, you know, part-time job. I'm teaching still. So I have lots of interaction with young women, young men and young women. And I get to have
interesting, wonderful, blessed conversations with them and just be a different example. Because I want to take responsibility today, and I'm not a survivor of anything, right? I'm somebody who had something happen, and it wasn't a good thing. But I'm betting somebody did something to that guy, because people who feel good about themselves don't hurt other people, and they certainly don't prey on children, right? So a wounded bird wounded another bird. Surprise. But the buck stops here because I take responsibility, and I don't want to be a victim. And that guy got forgiven years ago. I mean, that's amazing. So that's what starts getting birthed here, okay? So then that fifth step, of course, this all happens when I, you know, go out and I do a fifth step with somebody. And the fifth step, and again, you have those pages there telling you what, you know, what all the steps are that correspond. So, yeah, step 5, 72 to 75, make sure you give away that fifth step. It's funny, I'd just gotten a call from somebody a couple of weeks ago who wanted to know if she really needed to read her fifth step to her sponsor. And again, I always, my first question to somebody is always, well, what does your sponsor say about that? I don't weigh in and give my 2 cents. I want to hear what their sponsor says. And, you know, she said, well, her sponsor thought it was a good idea. And I just kind of wondered aloud then why she was calling, trolling for more information. But we ended up looking it up in the book. You know, and the book's pretty clear about this. It says if you don't give this away, good luck. Good luck hanging on to it. And there's a thing that it talks about on the bottom of 75, and it says after you've done a four step and given it away and a fifth step, go home and take an hour and just sit quietly and kind of let it settle. It's a wonderful thing. And what has always happened for me, because I subscribe to that idea that, you know, we keep going through the steps over and over and over again. There are two schools of thought in the MOTHER program, right, in Alcoholics Anonymous. The first one was largely influenced by Bill and the New York crowd, and they said you go through the steps once and then work through steps 10 through 12 for the rest of your life. Dr. Bob, the Ohio contingency, said, no, you keep going through the steps over and over again. Well, I was from Michigan originally, so got influenced by that group. And so I just have been cycling through the steps in this program and in other programs that I'm in. I'm in a few other programs. So I've done, you know, many four steps, 30, 35 four steps probably. And, you know, it's a wonderful thing, and it's always been a holy experience. And then, you know, 5, 6 weeks later, I'll behave in a way that's radically different than I've ever behaved before, and I realize it's a direct result of having done a four-step and given it away in a fifth step. Because what I'm doing in that four-step process is I'm very, very, very gently humbling myself before God and another human being, and I'm trusting you. And given where I came from, trusting another person does not come naturally. That's the most valuable thing I feel like I get out of giving away a four-step, doing a fifth-step, is that I trusted somebody enough. I trusted you weren't going to leave me. That who I was wasn't going to send you running and screaming out of the room, right? So that's wonderful. I love that. And then step 6 and 7, they're given a whole 2 paragraphs. Top of 76, there's a couple paragraphs. And for me, what I do with step 6 and 7, because, again, that too will also be a process that you're going to be spending a lifetime on and dealing primarily as you're looking at a 10th step and, as the book describes it, the 11th step is both what you do at night and what you do the next morning, but we'll get to that in a minute. But you're going to be dealing with the whole character defects thing. But the big thing that I do with sponsees is they get really excited because I say, do a list of your whole, all the character defects, and they get really excited, right? Because we are people who are very, very hard on ourselves. We kind of get off on it. That's one of our character defects, right? That pridefulness and that self-hate and that, you know, grittiness. If they get really excited and they say, oh, yeah, do as many as you want, right? And I say, oh, there's one catch, though. You then have to do a list of your assets. So as many character defects as you come up with the assets too. Talk to you tomorrow. Bye. Right, click. And inevitably, people have a hard time coming up with their assets. They do. And I'll help them, right? Or I'll give them another day or two. Because the truth is, there's nothing holy about the fact that I can give you a list of my character defects. But and this is not the case anymore. I, you know, very humbly and lovingly tell you that I can give you as many character assets today as character defects. Is it my default? No. My default is that I'm hard on myself, and there's a part of me that really gets off on that. Again, that's another character defect. It's pridefulness and low self-esteem. Low self-esteem, of course, is a character defect. I didn't know that. But I have them do a list of the defects and a list of the assets. Why? Well, remember the 7-step prayer. My Creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, the good and the bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. But it says the good and the bad. So I have to recognize both. We've got to see both, right?
and then we move to the eighth step. And the eighth step, the big book tells me, that's on mid-76 is the eighth step. So they don't spend a lot of time on the eighth step, spend more time on the ninth step, 76 to 84. But the eighth step, the big book tells me that I made my eight-step list when I took my four-step. So that tells me every name on my four-step is going to be on my eight-step. Okay, so remember Joe, who molested me when I was a kid? So now all of a sudden, Joe is on my eight-step list. What? Right? What? How do I owe amends to a guy who molested me when I was 10 years old? Well, remember what I said my part was? My part had nothing to do with the fact that I was molested. Zero. Nobody should be molested. No child should have that experience. But I am responsible for the fact that for years I did not forgive Joe. And I made every man pay the price, including my dad and my brothers. Made all of them pay the price. For that, I'm responsible. So I got to that. They were on the list. And then it's time to make amends. Now, nobody ever has to go to a pedophile and make, and again, we're just talking about this case, and obviously this is not his real name, and this man is deceased. But we're only talking about this because this is a big kahuna. If you get this, you're probably going to get the smaller ones, right? So we're talking about the big deal. But nobody ever has to approach a pedophile. And just so you know, about 98% of the people I sponsor have been molested at some point. So it probably has something to do with chronic slippers. Maybe water rises to its own level. Who knows? Who knows? But I know they find me, right? So, and have had amazing things happen with working with chronic slippers as we are doing, you know, this work. For whatever reason, they're ready at this time and had real profound things that have happened. You know, people have remembered things on four steps that they've never uttered aloud, ever. Men in their, you know, I had a guy, middle-aged guy, a guy in his 50s who remembered something that he'd never said it out loud. He'd never even gotten conscious about it. And it was intense, right? And he had a profound healing around it. At any rate, so quite obviously, I've never been directed myself, nor would I have taken the direction, right? That one I would have drawn the line at if I had a sponsor who wanted me to make an amends, but nobody would, right? Nobody's unreasonable here. We just want you to get free. But I do need to make some kind of an amends gesture. So what we do is write letters. And I don't even know which sponsor it came from. Maybe it's the one I have now. I have no idea. I mean, I have sponsors in myriad programs. But I write letters. So I wrote Joe a letter. And there are three components to an amends letter. And I tell him to keep it very, very simple, as I was directed to keep it very, very simple. Again, three components. The first part is, Dear Joe, I forgive you for having molested me when I was 10 years old. Second part, please forgive me for not having forgiven you for 20 years for your having molested me when I was 10. And then I was directed, right, because the book, it doesn't give you specific direction because Bill gave himself a lot of leeway because Bill had real gremlins in his life, right, so real things he was wrestling with and dealing with, and we don't need to get into that. But, you know, suffice it to say our wonderful founders were very, very human people who had real human issues, and I love that, right? That makes this very accessible and a fit for all of us. But it doesn't give a lot of specific direction. So at some point I got directed by a sponsor on this. But I am real clear that it's saying resentment's about not forgiving. So you got to forgive these people. That's what the whole process is about, is love, getting closer to loving and forgiving. So, again, that letter. I forgive you for having molested me. Please forgive me for not having forgiven you for 10 years, right? And I write that time period down because I want to know how long I've been carrying that burden. That was not a burden that had anything to do with Joe. Joe didn't have a problem with the behavior. That's why he did it. He didn't have a problem with it. I'm the one who had a problem, and for that I'm responsible. I am. Why? Why do I want to do this work that seems to make no sense? Remember what we read and how it works. Willing to go to any lengths. And it says that at various places in the book. You better get it. You're going to have to turn yourself completely inside out if you want what we have here. I take that stuff seriously. So this is just an outgrowth of that. It just is, right? So it makes sense to me. And the third thing that I do on an amends letter is I write something wonderful and lovely about Joe. Because that's not all that Joe was. Joe was a family friend of ours. I remember he used to save wheat pennies for me. Remember those pennies with the wheat? He used to save those for me because he knew I liked those. And I bring that up because the problem is when Joe's done something awful for me,
right? I start looking at him like this, and this is all I see is that, like, I'm staring at that tree. That's all I see, Joe the pedophile. That's not all Joe was. That's not all he was in his life. Just like I am not my worst moment on my fourth step, the worst thing I've ever done, right? That's not who I am. That's not all that I am. It was a moment. It was part of who I was. I'm responsible for those things, but it's not all who I am. Well, that's not all who Joe is either. And it's real important for me to get that, and I write down a letter, and then I sign off. My sponsor directed me, sign off the highest you can go. And the highest I can always go is signing off Love Sheila. And that's usually what I'll do, is sign off Love Sheila. I signed it off, I remember, on his letter, and I got transformed. I mean, I got transformed because I got free. And again, it had nothing to do with Joe. It wasn't like I was forgiving Joe. I was forgiving me. I was laying my burden down. Right? So that's the profound thing that happens between a fourth step and that eight-step list and then going forward and making those amends. And when I look at the kinds of amends, okay, are we almost done and that's why you're here? Okay, babe. Okay. So that's the ninth step, right? So I do all that work. So every name, because the big book says, I made my eight-step list when I took my inventory. So how that translated for my sponsor years ago when I first was introduced to this, that was how it became clear to me. Every name, everybody on my four-step gets some kind of an amends to me. And it doesn't mean, and very few of those amends involve me knocking on somebody's door and either putting money in their hands or giving them a sincere apology. Oftentimes, those amends were those kind of letters that I told you about, writing letters. Just seeing my part, recognizing, especially if they'd done something hurtful, recognizing that they'd done it and forgiving them, right? Freeing myself of the resentment, okay? And then telling them that I'm sorry for not having forgiven you because I'm responsible for that because I carried this burden, right? You came and left a 20-pound bag of rocks, put them on my shoulders, and I carried them for the next 20 years. I didn't have to keep carrying those. I didn't know how to put it down. Who knows how to put that down, especially when you're 10 years old? Who knows how to put that down? But that's what I come to program to learn to do, right? So that's what we do here. So then we have step 10, which is mid-84. And it's interesting to the bottom of 85. And it's interesting. This is where it gets, you know, fun, right? Because you have the big book's take on step 10 versus the 12 and 12's take. So what the big book says is that a 10-step inventory is something that you are doing throughout the course of the day, and you're doing it immediately. And there are four steps. So in the middle of 84, it tells us that there are four steps to take when you get off the beam. And it gives you different examples if you get angry, fearful, any of that stuff. For me, that's just how I describe it, getting off the beam. And it's going to show up for me as anger or fear because I have issues with my anger and I have issues with fear, right? But anger, there was a lot of anger in my home, so it's my default. Because what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to keep you away from those vulnerable feelings. That's all anger does, is it's just keeping, you know, right? It's keeping you away. It's putting up that wall. Because I feel vulnerable, and I feel very, very unprotected. So the big book, four steps, right, in the middle of page 84. And my little acronym from this thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. Our next function is to grow. Okay. Continue to watch. Here it is. Here where it's going to talk about the four steps. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, all right, here's the four steps. Okay. My little acronym is God makes apples sweet. So it says, we ask God at once to remove them. So that's the first step. God, right? God makes apples sweet. God, ask God to remove it. So let's say I'm going along and all of a sudden I have health fears come up. Like, oh my God, what's going to happen to me? Ah, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, oh wow, this is time for that 10 step thing, right? God, please remove the fear. Have some health fears coming up. Then it says, we discuss them with someone immediately. So again, God makes apples sweet. M, man, right? Man or woman. I call somebody, make an outreach call. Hey, Jenya, it's Sheila calling. Just making a quick outreach call. You got a minute? Yeah, sure, Sheila, what's up? You know, just doing that 10-step thing, having some health fears come up, and I just wanted to share it with somebody. I got some health fears. Oh, Sheila, what's going on? You know what, Jenya, I appreciate your concern, hon. I don't even need to get into the story. Just need to tell somebody. I'm turning it over. Thank you. Bye. Right? Quick. Right? God makes apples sweet. And then it says, we make amends if we've harmed anybody. Well, usually when I have fears coming up, I haven't harmed anybody. It's not without, you know, it's not out of the realm of possibility. I can certainly be feeling fears and I can just give my husband the once over, right? Because anything to distract me.
but usually that's not the case. And then it says get into service. Now, interestingly enough, the first person in 12-step programs who introduced this to me said, and 12-step service doesn't count. But explain that. My sponsor's, you know, kind of like, I don't have to explain it. Right, just do it. 12-step service doesn't count. So I remember the first time I did this. I was going into my gym, right, and I just had been introduced to this. And I was like 20 years sober. And I didn't know this. And certainly nobody was talking about this. And I hadn't heard it talked about here or in the sister food program. I hadn't heard it talked about anywhere here. But this got pointed out to me. I was a long time, you know, doing the deal here. And I didn't know that these gems were in the book. And I've read these pages many times. I was directed years ago to read two pages a day in the big book. You'll get through it about 9-10 months. So I've done this many times, had never seen this. So I'm walking in the gym, had some real huge health fears come up, just kind of out of the blue. Oh, I'm afraid something bad's going to happen. Nah. I thought, oh, this is probably that 10-step thing she was talking about. I asked God to remove it. I made an outreach call, like I just said. Hadn't heard anybody, so I didn't need to make amends, and I started picking up trash on my way into the gym. Deposited the trash, washed my hands, went to my yoga class. It was gone within 5 minutes. And I got to tell you, this was a big fear. This was not like a little fear. I mean, this was a big fear, and it was gone. And I got it then, that this is really powerful. So that's how the big book describes a 10-step. Then what the big book talks about in the 11th step is starts at the bottom of 86 and goes to the end of the chapter, and it suggests prayer and meditation. And it's talking about the inventory that we take at night. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology? Blah, 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 blah. Those are the things that the 12 and 12 describes as a 10-step, right? Most of us talk about, oh, do you do a daily 10-step? Do you do your 10-step at night? And again, it doesn't matter what you call it. Whether you call it a 10-step or an 11-step, whatever it is. Just so you know, the big book describes the 10-step both as what we do at night and on awakening, which starts at the bottom of 86. On awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. And it gives us a series of steps we can take there, things that directs us to get in place and get aligned with at the beginning of the day so that we can let that intuition and that intuitive sense, that internal sense of knowing, we can activate that. So that's really powerful. Make sure you take a look at that, right? So that's step 11. What I do with my sponsees, and it looks like I did it in this particular book too, is I have them highlight the very specific steps from 86 to 88. I always call it the 86 to 88 blitz. I got a buddy who has recorded these, this whole two pages, and he listens to it on his way to work. So that's his thing, because it just keeps him real clear about how he's supposed to get aligned during the course of the day. And this is where it also talks about that we are, you know, if I get upset or angry, I am to constantly remind myself I'm no longer running the show. Humbly saying to myself many times each day, thy will not mine be done. It works. I'll be lovingly disciplined in the way I've just outlined. Can you see what happens if you're really doing everything that this book directs you to do? Quite frankly, if I'm doing everything this book directs me to do, I don't need to go to Al-Anon. Technically, right? But I don't do it, right? I'm always in your business, particularly my husband's business, right? But if I'm doing everything that it tells me to do, I'm not going to be in trouble. You see how easy and effortless it really becomes then? Do you see how they then could say, this is the story of how thousands of men and women have recovered? Because if you really do this, again, specifically, go through all the steps, admitting I'm powerless and my life is unmanageable when I'm trying to control things and run the show. Turning it over, right, to a God of my understanding to get free of the insanity, right, knowing that God will restore me to sanity. And if I will let God be in charge, as the third step tells me, I'm going to be free of fear today, in the future, and in life. I have nothing to fear. If I will just let God be in charge, that means diagnoses, nobody signing, you know, nobody buying my screenplay, no Oscar on my mantle, any of that nonsense, right, the house, whatever it is, the husband, right, won't put a napkin in his lap consistently, I don't get that, right? Like, none of that stuff is going to matter. Then the fourth step, where I'm writing down everything. If I hurt you, if you hurt me, I'm writing it down and I'm going to tell somebody. I'm going to have that holy moment where I'm going to do a fifth step with somebody and I'm going to trust you that you are going to love me unconditionally. Because when I get that from another human being, I can't be running around thinking God's punitive. I mean, how can I think God is punitive and hurtful if I've read stuff, myriad stuff to people over the years, horrible things that I've done, bratty, bratty stuff, and they've still loved me. They've still greeted me in meetings, given me outreach calls, loved me, continue to just, you know, want to be in my life. How could God be anything less? looking at my character defects and my assets, realizing the darkness and the light are both alike to God. Both are true. I'm a bratty brat, and I'm a lovely, lovely angel. Both are true. And I'm not afraid of either today. I have problems with my anger, and my default is that I will just be empathic and love you and adore you. Both are true, right? So I kind of know all of it. And then realizing I am responsible for everything that I wrote down on that four step. So if you hurt me, I got to forgive you. If I hurt you, I got to forgive me too. And I got to tell you, that's almost harder for me to forgive myself. It really is. It felt easier as I think about it now. Thank you for nodding your head. I'm glad I'm not the only one. It actually felt easier to forgive Joe than it did for me to forgive myself. One of the worst things I did, I was really mean to a girl who was, you know, like developmentally disabled. I'm 49, so I went to school in the 70s in elementary school. And that was when they used to send, you know, children, everybody went to school together. And that's probably a great thing. I don't know how it works now. But this girl was, it was either in the third or fourth grade, and I was really unkind to this girl. And I put her on myriad four steps, and, you know, I've forgiven myself, but it, you know, it keeps coming up. And I was just saying this to a sponsee the other day. Maybe the reason it keeps coming up is not because I still need to forgive, you know, or think about her or remember as she was sobbing on the playground, you know, and I was responsible for it because I said something, pushed her, whatever bratty thing it was I'd done. But I will never forget hearing that girl sob and seeing the, you know, the mucus run down her. I will never forget it. And it is essential that I forgive myself of that stuff. It is essential. So maybe the reason it keeps showing up, and I'll write, you know, when I do a four-step, if she shows up, let's just call her Mary. If Mary shows up on my four-step and she's still on my mind, I write her down again, right? Acknowledge what I did. Acknowledge how it affected me. Acknowledge my part. And then maybe it's because it's just another opportunity for me to see myself more lovingly and more compassionately yet again. And just realizing, there's nothing holy about me being able to forgive a pedophile who molested me if I can't forgive myself for being mean to Mary on the playground. You know what I'm saying? But that's a hard one for me to get. And again, that's a character defect. That's not noble. I thought that was like my noble Catholic upbringing. That's pridefulness, right? That's, oh, no, you don't understand. I'm better than you. I actually should. It's good that I have a hard time. It's good that I'm so hard on myself. At the end of the day, it's because I think I'm better than you that I want to be so hard on myself, right? It is not fueled by, I ain't no Mother Teresa, right? It is not fueled by anything other than there's a payoff for me if I'm not forgiving myself. So that has to stop, okay? So looking at that holy process in 8 and 9, then look at 10th step. When I get off the beam, I do not have to stay in it. You know, think about this the next time you're in a meeting and you're listening to people share at the lectern. Right, and I had a sponsor who said, look, we are supposed to be sharing our experience, strength, and hope as a program of attraction for the newcomer. Be very, very clear about the fact. You don't get up there and unload. That's what I was taught. And again, I have zero opinion about what you are doing, but I'm real clear about what I was taught. And I was taught that you share your experience, strength, and hope, and it is how has this transformed my life. Right, that's why I love the positive pitches. And I don't care what somebody, you know, if you got up there, I don't care what you share. If you didn't have to dive into a punch bowl of food because of it, I don't care what you share. To me, it's a positive pitch. But the deal is I am there to inspire the newcomer. I really am. So I do that by sharing from this place about how I got transformed in my life. That's how I want to share. That's what I want to do. So when I am looking at, you know, the miracle of being angry or cranky, and yet I've got a step. It's right there on page 84. People always come up to me and ask me, like, what are those steps? What's it? God makes what? What is it? God? It's on page 84. We'll make it easy for you. Make up your own little acronym. Mine's God makes apple sweet. Ask God to remove it. Share it with another person. Make amends if you've hurt anybody, and get into service. And I would invite you that 12-step service doesn't count. Do something else. Pick up litter. You know, pick up somebody else's dog doo-doo and throw it away. Like, do that, right? I used to get so angry. Now I bless the person. Maybe they didn't have time. Maybe they didn't have newspaper with them. Who cares? They didn't have time to do it, so their sister following behind did it. I'm not doing it for them anyway. I'm doing it for God, right? So look at that. I don't ever have to stay in this stuff. I don't think about that, the power of step 10. I don't need to stay in anger or fear. How many times have you eaten over anger or fear? especially if you're a slipper. Or how many times have you not eaten, but you still make your husband, your dog, your kid, your cat pay the price? Think about this. That's a gem that's in the book. On 84, when you get caught up, get yourself free. You can do that. It gives you steps. Then I get to the 11th step. Tell me, pay attention to what you did at night and acknowledge it. Emerson said, any life worth living is worth recording. Right? So pay attention to it. Take a look at what you did and how you behaved. And then when you wake up the next day, start thinking about what's going to go on for that day and how you want to frame the day. From page 86 to 88, it gives you the whole blitz. Says, set your day up this way. And make sure you are praying and meditating. And I'll tell you what, if you are not meditating on a daily basis, you have not gotten what you came for. You have not. You just have not gotten what you came for. I make all my sponsees start meditating. I say, I don't care what step you're on. We're starting now. You start 5 minutes a day. And if you don't have 5 minutes a day to sit quietly, I don't know how you got out of bed and got your shoes on this morning. Check and make sure your underwear is, you know, you don't have the back and the front. Because I don't know how you did it. If you don't have 5 minutes to sit down and give to yourself and give to God and give to your children and your husband, you don't think your husband and your children are going to reap the benefits, or your wife is going to reap the benefits because you sat quietly? Try it for a month and then call me. Right? So do that. I mean, when we do that stuff, we get transformed. And then we're back to chapter 7 again. So now we've gone through the steps, and now we've cycled back to chapter 7 again, working with others, where it says, you know, working with other people will become the high point of our lives. And I'm just here to tell you, it certainly is for me. And I was very, very selfish. I never wanted to sponsor people. There was one time in how I'd been stepped up as a step sponsor, and I remember there were myriad people after the meeting. So now I'm a food inventory and a step sponsor, right? And there were many people who needed a sponsor, and I remember just running out the door thinking, oh, no. I got into food that day. That day I lost my abstinence. And you know what my thinking was? It was the day before Easter. The last thing I thought before I put that bite in my mouth is I thought, well, I'll start tomorrow. I'll start all over tomorrow, and Easter will be my abstinence date. Months. I don't know how long it was I got abstinent. And then in the meantime, I blew an incredible business deal because I was in the sugar. And I ended up getting out of the sugar, but I was still paying the price. I mean, blew a monster deal. I was in film school. We had a head of a studio who wanted one of my projects, and I blew it. Because that's what I do when I'm in the food. I'm not a functioning compulsive eater. And going in and out, I'm paying such a monster price. Didn't have a clue the price I was paying, right? So I get back to that working with others, right, in that chapter, and it says, great, now you have been given a gift. Now you know what you get to do? You get to give this gift away to everybody who wants it for the rest of your life. And that's the blessing. And by the time you get to that point, right, so now they're reading that chapter yet again. So they read it about 6 weeks before, 7 weeks before. Now they're reading it again, and they have a much different perspective because they're standing on the other side of the line realizing, oh, that's right, I actually do want sponsees who are willing to do the work, right? So that's my experience in working the steps. So keep this information, right? So this is talking about the steps in the big book. And again, you can augment, you know, talk with your sponsor. It's always between you and your sponsor and God. And, you know, figure it out. Maybe you do some of this on weekends and work it in. I mean, we have, you know, all kinds of wonderful new questions and stuff. I mean, there's, you know, it's great, all the material. But everything, as Ray D was reminding me this morning, this and the 12 and 12 were the source material that she and Fred were working from. So all we're doing is looking at our primary source material, right? And I'm an academic at heart. This is primary source material. All the answers are right here. It's just we don't always want to do what it asks us to do. But I'll tell you what, and I don't always do that 10th step, and I sometimes forget it. And it's a shame when I do because I shoot my mouth off. I say something horrible to my husband, and then I'm apologizing an hour later, and, you know, it's just terrible. And if I would have just caught it at the beginning. So it's a practice thing, you know. I just want to say that's why I sponsor lots of people, and I want to be in lots of conversation about this stuff. Because this stuff can transform you if I am doing everything it asks me to do. That's why they can say they were recovered, because they don't look at life the same way. It's that vital spiritual experience and the psychic change. Silkworth and Jung were both talking about the same thing when they used those two different terms. And that transformation is, I am no longer going to be a victim, and I'm going to take full responsibility for everything in my life. And working these steps in the book shows me how I do that. So, that's it for me. Thank you for coming.